Thank you, George. My name is Art, and I'm an alcoholic. Hi, everybody. There are two events that happen with some regularity in my life that always leave me a little, not speechless, but a little anxious. Those two events are on those moments when I stand behind the pulpit as a minister, and those moments when I stand behind the lectern as an alcoholic. And they're both important to me for the same reason, because on both occasions, we're talking about the sacred, which is God. We're talking about the beautiful, the meaningful, which is life, yours and mine. Time has a great deal of importance to us who are alcoholics and to our families. And all that there is of time is caught up in this one little moment we have right now. We've had some moments this weekend that have been very beautiful. This is my first time here, and I'm grateful to the Board of Trustees and to Clarence for asking me to come. It's a beautiful place. Yesterday afternoon, I had the opportunity to go to a little chapel over here, nearby village, Tracy City, I believe. And it's a very lovely place. And as I stood in that chapel with some good friends, in my mind, I could sort of picture, through the years, the many people who sat within those walls and who have, in their own way, poured out to the God of their understanding their hopes, their aspirations, their dreams, their disappointments, their failures. I could see them as they have wrestled with their own inadequacies, as they have worried and been anxious because of the many things that happened to them and to their loved ones. And as we took a moment to pray, it was a time of gratitude, a time in which each of us who happened to be there at that moment, I'm sure, was expressing to the God of our understanding our individual gratitude for that which has brought us together, for that which has given us this weekend here at Mount Eagle together. Time is touched with grace . All of us in this room have been not just touched with grace, but we've been struck by grace. Because all of us in this room have had experiences that have really involved every fiber of our being. We are persons who, it has been said, perhaps hurt a little more freely than some others. I don't know that that's really true, but I know that certainly we have felt it. And in the midst of our hurts, what do you think it was that allowed us to endure? It was grace. There are those of us who've had magnificent dreams, only to find those dreams shattered as the days pass by. And when you try to pick up the pieces of broken dreams, it's a difficult task at best. And yet we have gone on trying to pick them up, but only by grace. Because when we've tried in our own efforts without the grace being present, we haven't been able to get it together. We have known the loss of loved ones. We have known the loss of well-laid plans. And what do you think brought us through those moments? Again, it was grace. Where grace is present, God is present, however defined, by whatever name you call him, however you understand him, however I understand him. Where grace is present, God is present. In this place, God is present, because grace abounds in this room. In this place, God is present because you and I are here. I'm one who believes that God lives in human lives. I'm one who believes that God is not just someone out yonder beyond the clouds who sort of looks down on what he has created and shifts it this way and then that way and then that way and then that way. He's there too, yes, but I believe very strongly that he's within us. Within every human being there is something of the divine. By God's grace, your divinity and mine touch each other, and we know each other a little better. We care a little more strongly for each other. We appreciate each other a little more. Yes, my name's Art Graham, and I am a recovering alcoholic. And as I see it, just as the illness of alcoholism is progressive, so also is the recovery from alcoholism progressive. Some people I know have TB. Some people I know have diabetes. Some people I know have galloping dandruff. Some people I know have chronic hangnail. Some people I know have a lot of other things. Me, I have alcoholism. And I used to simply say, I'm an alcoholic. But in the last couple of years, I have gotten in the habit of saying, because I feel I want to say, I'm an alcoholic, so what? And many times this causes a great deal of concern among my fellow AA friends, because they get the impression that somehow I'm sort of downgrading the illness of alcoholism when I say that. I'm not downgrading the illness, and I hope you understand that I don't intend to downgrade the illness of alcoholism in any way. But when I say I'm an alcoholic, so what? I'm trying to suggest to myself, to keep reminding myself, that there is more to all of life than just the acceptance of my illness of alcoholism. I'm trying to remember that one of the ways that I might be of help to the other suffering alcoholic is to be able to say to him, yeah, I'm an alcoholic, so what? This doesn't mean life's over. This doesn't mean that everything has fallen in and without any possibility of your getting out from under. It's another way of saying to them that there's still hope. It's another way of saying that, yes, it is an incurable illness, but it's arrestable. It's another way of saying, yes, you can walk with your head up again. It's another way of saying, yes, you can have your self-respect back. It's another way of saying, yes, life can have meaning. Yes, it can have purpose. Yes, it can have direction. It's another way of saying, you got to get committed. Committed to something that has meaning for you. And then you can live. So I'm an alcoholic. So what? I wish it were possible to spend all of my life in meetings such as this, and I guess we all do. But we have come almost to that point where we're going to say goodbye. And as all of us know, this is a very difficult time. We'll leave here and we'll go our separate ways, and you'll go back to your particular tasks and I'll go back to mine. Tomorrow morning at 8:30, I'll be in the Richmond City Jail. This time I won't be pulling time as such. I've done that too, but I'll be there as chaplain for the inmates of the city jail in Richmond, some 575 of them. And later in the day, I'll be at the city nursing home with 200 old people, 70% of whom are bedridden. Sometime during the day, I'll make it over to the juvenile detention home with 40 youngsters between the ages of 7 and 17. Kids who feel as if the whole world is against them. And before night falls, I'll get to the Virginia Home for Incurables, where there are 110 people, all of them diagnosed as medically incurable. And their illnesses are different from mine, but we share the fact that we have an incurable illness. And the guys and the gals who are down in the city jail are there for many and varied reasons, but we share something, because we can talk the same language, because we know the heartbreak and the loneliness that is a part of our lives. And the kids who are at the detention home, we share something in common with them. What I'm suggesting to you is, when we go back to our particular tasks, we'll be out of the context of a meeting such as this. And if AA means anything, if it works at all, and I know it does, it has to be an AA that works for me when I leave such hallowed halls as these. It has to be a program that works for me when I'm in the city jail, or at the nursing home, or the detention home. It has to be a program that when I come down off the mountaintop and go back to the valley of my everyday activities, gives me strength and the support that I need for the day. Well, I have that in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. The society of which I'm a part, the community in which I live, don't really care anything about my illness, generally speaking. Now, there are professionals, of course, who care, and there are individual members of families who care. But society as a whole isn't really too concerned about the illness of alcoholism, any more than they're concerned about the illnesses of many other persons in the world. What concerns society as a whole primarily is whether or not we can function as a part of that society. I come to places like this. I go to my meetings in my own home group so that I will be able to continue to function as a part of a meaningful community and a society. For that which I need to have to make me a real live human being, I find in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. So you see, as an alcoholic, I still must learn to function in an acceptable way in what is basically a non-alcoholic society. The purpose of AA, then, is to help me along the road to recovery, to help me arrest my illness so that this alcoholic can function in what is basically a non-alcoholic world. One of the reasons why I drank so hard for so long was that I sought a personality change, and I wanted to be different from the way I saw myself, because I didn't like me, and I didn't like you, and I didn't like God, and I didn't like anything to do with life. But I wanted to like me, and I wanted to like you. And I wanted to like God, or at least felt that he liked me. And I wanted life to have some meaning for me. And I came to Alcoholics Anonymous not knowing who I was. I came trying to find some way that I might have some self-identity. And when I was able to identify as an alcoholic, I thought, Eureka, I have found it. And in a real sense, I had. But thank God the program says there's more than that. There's more than simply getting dry. There's a business of learning how to live. And that's what I wanted more than anything else in the world. When I came to AA, you folks told me we got a program. It requires rigorous honesty. But rarely have we seen anybody fail who has thoroughly followed our paths. And these are the steps we took, all 12 of them. And you laid it out for me. And I tried to follow what you suggested. And as a result of following your suggestions, and because this program does work, I have not found it necessary to take a drink today, nor since April the 25th of 1960. And I thank my God for that. Because this program works, I am now in the process of becoming, and I will never have fully become, but I am in the process of becoming a person who can function as an alcoholic in a non-alcoholic world such as ours. Now, the purpose of AA says in part, AA is a fellowship of men and women. I'd like for us to think for just a couple of minutes about the word fellowship, if you will. The world is filled with organizations, associations, corporations, councils, foundations, troops, societies, armies, units, groups of all sorts. But there aren't many fellowships around. The fact that AA is a fellowship has tremendous importance to me for many reasons. I'd like to list a couple of them. The fact that AA is a fellowship tells me that we are not a society of medical doctors. Therefore, we have no business trying to tell medical doctors how to treat their patients or how to operate their clinics. We may not agree with them in many instances, but we need them, and the suffering alcoholic needs them. Because when I came into this program 12 years ago, AA claimed a membership of 250,000. At that time, the figures most often thrown around about the number of alcoholics in this country were 5 to 5.5 million. 12 years later, we claim a membership of 500,000. We've doubled. But so has the number of alcoholics. Now the number most often thrown around is 10 million. And many people say this is a very conservative number. So we need these doctors and their clinics, their attempts to be of help to the suffering alcoholic. So all I'm suggesting is that as a fellowship, AA reminds me that we are not a society of doctors. But it also tells me that when those doctors ask us for our experiences, we'll be ready and willing and anxious to share those experiences with them. The fact that AA is a fellowship reminds me that we are not an association of professional theologians, even though we do seem to have a pretty hefty number of clergy in our midst. Except for Baptists. There aren't too many Baptist clergymen in AA, and I'd like to stand up and testify as a Baptist clergyman. But I tell you, that's another story in itself. I don't think we want to get into that one today. Since we are not, on the whole, an association of professional theologians, we have no just reason for bad-mouthing the clergy in their attempts to help, or for constantly referring to the members of the church as that bunch of hypocrites. They may be, but we need them. The suffering alcoholic needs them. And slowly but surely, they're beginning to learn a little bit more about the illness of alcoholism. So, when asked, we will gladly share with the clergy and the members of their churches God as we understand Him, in the hope that in the sharing thereof, they may gain not only new insight, but new understanding of the illness of alcoholism. The fact that AA is a fellowship reminds me that we are not an organized group of psychologists or psychiatrists. Thus, it ill becomes us to put these professionals down. There are some of us here this morning who would not be here were it not for a psychiatrist or a psychologist. And there are times when I know that some of us say and feel very strongly that, well, I went to a psychiatrist and he didn't do anything for me. Maybe one of the reasons why he didn't do anything for us is because we wouldn't let him do anything for us. Besides that point, there are some here in this room today who did go to psychiatrists in order to get well enough to come to AA. And I've talked to some of them since I've been here this weekend. So it's time that we remember that as a fellowship, we need not downgrade these people. We need them too. And when they ask us, and they always do, when they ask us to share with them, we will tell them how it was with us. And let them, in their skill and wisdom, interpret that in whatever way they wish, in the hope that it might be helpful to some alcoholic somewhere. The fact that AA is a fellowship reminds me that as a fellowship, and as individual members of this fellowship, we are not God. Seems to me like this is a point where sometimes I want to get hung up. Not simply because I'm also a preacher, but I find it awfully easy for me to want to play God. I find it terribly easy for me to want to think of myself as somebody's savior. Lord, Lord, I'm not. But I have to keep reminding myself that I'm not. And in this role of playing God, I also sometimes find myself thinking about perfection, you know? Of course, our book tells us, quit thinking about it, you ain't gonna make it, man. Spiritual progress, not perfection. But it's so easy to get hung up on it. So easy to try. And after we've come along for a couple of years in the program, we can get discouraged if we start comparing ourselves with somebody else. If we start saying, well, why am I not like him? Why don't I have all of what he has? How come I'm not a little closer to perfection now, as close perhaps as that guy is, or this guy over here? We are always in danger of losing our sobriety when we begin to compare ourselves with somebody else, because there will always be greater and lesser than ourselves. The only possible sort of comparison we can make is to look at who we are now and where we stand, and to look at who we were a year ago or 2 years ago or 6 months ago when we came to the program and say, that's where I was. This is where I am. What has happened in between? If there has been any kind of growth at all. And if you've been sober 6 months, most likely there's been some growth. If there's been any kind of growth at all, then I am getting what I came to this program for. Sobriety, spiritual progress. Perfection, let it hang out there in the stars somewhere. I'm one who believes that if we aim at perfection, we always miss. And therefore, we begin to get discouraged because we don't ever achieve. I believe it's a lot safer for me to aim at 70% and hit it, maybe once in a while, than it is to aim at 100 and continually miss, because continued failure is bad for me. I can't fight it. So then, AA as a fellowship reminds me that I'm not God, and that we as a fellowship are not God. We're not all-powerful. We are not collectively or individually all-knowing. Therefore, this suggests to me that we do not have the right to insist that this program will work for everyone, because it will not. The big book tells us that it won't work for everyone. Those who are constitutionally incapable of being honest with themselves, the program doesn't work for them. Honesty is the beginning point. If we can't get past honesty, we haven't gotten anywhere at all. That's where it has to all hang together or fall apart. Now, the fact that AA is a fellowship is important to me for the reasons I've suggested, but they have a sort of negative ring about them, and they make us feel a little uncomfortable, I know. I'd like to suggest then that AA as a fellowship is important to me for a more positive reason. AA as a fellowship is important to me because it reminds me that I belong to you and that you belong to me. That we belong to each other. If you saw the last issue of The Grapevine, you saw probably a little article in there that someone wrote about sponsorship, in which they said that, they had real problems with this business of sponsorship, that they felt as if too many times we equated sponsorship with possessing, with having the right as a sponsor to tell another person what he had to do or what he could do or couldn't do. Well, that's not sponsorship to me. That's trying to live somebody else's life for them. But I voluntarily become a member of this fellowship. You voluntarily accept me as a member of this fellowship. I belong to you. You belong to me, not in the sense that you possess me, not in the sense that I possess you, but in the sense that together we share our experience and our strength and our hope. In the sense that we are mutual burden bearers and mutual joy sharers. In this sense, then I belong to you, and you belong to me. That's a marvelous feeling if you've never belonged to anybody, and many of us never did before we found AA. And if you never belonged or never felt anybody belonged to you, that you were really a part, then to come into this fellowship and to be a part is a marvelous, marvelous thing indeed. As a part of the fellowship of AA, we share our burdens, our griefs, our disappointments, our failures, all as a part of our experience. We share our good fortune, our growth, our recovery, our joy, our faith, all as a part of our strength. We share our dreams and our aspirations and our goals and our longings and our yearnings and our prayers, all as a part of our hope. So you see the importance of AA to us, of AA as being a fellowship, is almost more than we as humans can comprehend or explain. But just as AA is important as a fellowship to the recovering alcoholic, it is also important to the still suffering alcoholic. Because as you well know, the sick alcoholic is neither alive nor dead, though he constantly wishes he could be one or the other. He's neither hot nor cold. He's neither a dynamic person with a sense of direction, nor is he a sterile shell of unfeeling clay. The practicing alcoholic is a lukewarm organism who longs to know who he is, who longs to know himself and to know who he is as a person and where he is in the business of living as a person. And he must come to know who he is before he can truly determine who he wants to become. Now, I know that it's awfully easy for us to slip into the futility of analysis paralysis, and I'm not suggesting that we need to do that. But for me, I need to recognize who the old guy is before I can think about becoming a new person. And that's the idea, it seems to me, of step one. Recognizing who I am, an alcoholic whose life is unmanageable. And if I don't recognize that, then how am I going to become anybody else? We talk a lot about growing along spiritual lines. To grow is to move from here to there. And I remember a story I read, which you have read too, probably, of a wandering Jew named Jesus, who took off one day from Jerusalem to Jericho. But in order to get from Jerusalem to Jericho, he had to pass through Samaria. And the only thing significant about that is the fact that Samaria was hostile territory. Well, it's the same with us. To get from here where we are to here where we want to be as human beings, as persons, we have our individual Samarias that we have to pass through. That hostile area where all the problems that can possibly come to human beings are going to be a part of our lives, because that is life. We're going to try to make the move from where we are to where we want to be in the business of living, confident that even as we start out to try to make this move, we're going to be facing all kinds of problems, anxieties, burdens, cares. And if we've got our marbles with us, we ain't going to make that move by ourselves. We're going to look for some divine guidance to help us along the way. We've got a program that's designed to give us the divine guidance that we need to move from where we are as persons to where we want to be. So you see, this program is important to the still suffering alcoholic too. As a suffering alcoholic, and you know, it's always easier to stand at some point in time and look back on where you were. As a suffering alcoholic, using a little 20/20 hindsight vision, I recognize the fact now that I was a prisoner of my attitudes and my emotions, my feelings, my impulses, and all of these things held me in their grasp long before I was ever lodged in a prison made of stone or steel. You know that a good builder can build either a prison or a bridge with the same material. You give him the concrete and the mortar and the bricks, the necessary timbers, and he can make for you a prison or a bridge, depending on what the blueprint calls for. Well, in my act of alcoholism, as one who was using the building blocks given to me by the God of my understanding, I chose to build prisons rather than bridges. In my ongoing recovery from the illness of alcoholism, my choice is to build bridges rather than prisons. In my alcoholism, for instance, I built a prison of fear. We were talking, some of us this morning at the breakfast table, about the fact that some of us are shy. And it's always amusing to me to find that so many people think that those who get up in front of platforms like this aren't shy people. And I think most of us are. Very, very shy and withdrawn. And certainly this is true with me. And I heard that the table this morning was true of several others. I found that for me, one of the prisons that I built was a prison of the fear of people. I didn't know how to really act around people because I had a feeling they expected more of me than I could give. I felt inadequate to meet what they expected of me. So I was afraid of them. I was shy around them. I also discovered that I built a prison of fear that included the fear of failure. This grandfather, who was a Methodist minister that I lived with as a child, made it very clear that he expected me to have 100 on every test that came out of school. It was the sort of thing you could get 100 on. And if I came home with 90 or 95, he said, "Pat," and that's my middle name, he said, "Pat, that's a good grade, but it's not 100, and he gave me a whipping. So I became a little bit leery about failing in subjects, and if you're that leery, you know, you're going to cheat a little bit in order to make sure that you don't fail. But then I also discovered that I became a prisoner of the fear of success, because it seemed to me, and I learned this early, that the better able I was to succeed in a given task, whatever it was, the more was expected of me. The responsibility was put on top. You know, man, I didn't want any more responsibility. I was having hard enough time just keeping my head up. But the more you succeed, the greater will be the responsibility that's placed on you. And I discovered that early. So I saw myself, I see myself now, as I look back, as a person who built a prison of fear. The fear of people, the fear of failure, and the fear of success. By using the 12 steps of this program and by my association with you, by my attendance at Alcoholics Anonymous meetings, I'm trying now to build a bridge of faith because faith is the only thing that will replace fear. I'm awful glad Ray mentioned the fear last night. This is one of the things I maintain has not been dealt with enough, so far as I'm concerned. Fear is a part of the life of every alcoholic I've ever known. And I believe it must touch the lives of practically all of us who are alcoholics. Certainly this is true in my own case. The only thing that replaces it is faith. And this means faith in God as I understand Him. It means faith in myself. And it means faith in you, those who are around me. In my alcoholism, I built a prison of guilt and remorse. Constantly I felt guilty. You know, without going into any blow-by-blow description of my story, at an early age, I wanted to become a minister. I don't know why. Because I'd lived with a Methodist minister, and I thought it was a horrible life, but I found this compulsion within me to become a minister. I tried to run away from this, but it wouldn't turn me loose. And I had an awful lot of hang-ups because I found being brought up to believe that it was wrong to drink. I was drinking like a fiend, but still arguing with the business of becoming a preacher. How am I going to reconcile the two? And I couldn't get them to come together. And so in my inability to get them to mesh, my alcoholism, of course, increased. I was a prisoner of guilt, feeling guilty about drinking then, and a prisoner of remorse. My God, the remorse that came when the weekend was over and I went back to school on Monday morning. Now in my recovery, I'm trying to build, by God's grace and with the help of this program, a bridge wherein I am able to accept the fact that God takes me just like I am. That I don't have to reach any level of goodness to be acceptable to Him. The beautiful fact is that He accepts me just the way I am. And this willingness on His part to accept me like I am is all that allows me to grow. If He wouldn't take me like I am, I'd never be able to get anywhere else. So He accepts me the way I am. And I've learned that, and I'm learning it day by day. In my alcoholism, I built a prison of pride. I don't need you, God. I don't need you, wife. I don't need you, friend. I don't need you, employer. I can handle this business all by myself. And I couldn't handle it by myself. But my pride said, yes, you can. You don't need those people. In my recovery program, I'm trying to replace this prison of pride with a bridge of gratitude. And somebody asked me the other day, yeah, well, how do you become grateful if you don't have any feelings of gratitude within you? And the answer is, don't look for gratitude, my friend. Learn how you can become humble. Because humility is simply recognition of the fact I can't do it by myself. That which is of any eternal lasting value within me comes from the God of my understanding. If I can say that and mean it, then I'll be grateful. That will naturally follow as a result of the loss of the pride. In my alcoholism, I built a prison of brokenness. I felt separated from myself, separated from God, separated from other people. I felt as if I wasn't a part of anybody or anything. I felt as if this God that my grandfather had taught me about and that the seminary had tried to teach me about before it threw me out, that this God was out yonder somewhere in the distant skies and He didn't really care anything about me. He had some rules that I was supposed to follow, but if I didn't follow the rules, I would be crushed as a result. But I wouldn't ever know anything about His goodness and His love and His grace. So I felt separated from God. I felt separated from people because I was sure that they couldn't possibly care for a guy like me. I knew I didn't have any self-respect, and I knew they couldn't respect me either. So therefore, I felt separated from them. And I had that shattering experience, I think, of feeling totally disintegrated myself, of feeling separated from my own self, of feeling as if I'm not real, as if I just can't get enough things together to make me into a real dynamic human being. Therefore, I'm just a little bit of flotsam floating around through the airwaves. Well, in my program of recovery through this program, I'm trying to build a bridge of wholeness which recognizes the fact that I cannot live in a vacuum that I live only in relationships with people. And that unless I have an ongoing, meaningful relationship with another human being and with God as I understand Him, then I don't live at all. I might exist, but I don't live. The bridge of wholeness is one whereon I can stand with my wife and my friends and my employer and my God, and I can say, yes, in the midst of all this, I find life does have meaning after all. I find life does have purpose, and it has direction, and it's really worth living. It is beautiful indeed. In my alcoholism, I built a prison of non-forgiveness. Non-forgiveness. I don't know whether it's ever happened to you or not. It used to be for me that when somebody said something or did something that hurt me, my immediate reaction was, I'll get even with you. It may take me a while, but my time will come. And I've sat on many a bar stool and figured out what I was going to do when it got dark with a guy down at the other end of the bar who had made some smart remark, and I didn't have the guts at the time to tell him what I wanted. But if I could just wait till after dark and get that guy outside in the alley, somehow or another I'd get my revenge. This was the kind of thinking, of course, that I had. Unable to forgive either a real wrong or a fancied wrong. And most of the wrongs that had been done to me in my life were not real. They were the figments of my imagination. They were the fancied wrongs that I thought somebody had done to me when they really hadn't done it at all. For me, it took a while to learn something about this business of forgiveness. I was in seminary, and they taught me about forgiveness, but I didn't learn very much about it. I don't know why. Incidentally, just so nobody will ask me later, I had 2 years of seminary, was kicked out, stayed out a year, was allowed to go back and finish the third year, and somehow or another even got ordained as a minister. So I got through the school bit. They tried to teach me forgiveness, what it meant, but somehow or another it didn't come off for me in seminary. It came off for me at the third meeting I went to of Alcoholics Anonymous. The first two meetings were speaker meetings, similar to this, where my only reaction was good grief. Somebody gonna get up and talk about drinking experiences, I can match those, you know, it didn't mean anything to me. And the third meeting I went to was a discussion meeting. And in my own mind, I'd already said, if this one doesn't produce anything more for me than the other two did, then that's ample proof that AA don't work for me. And the third meeting was a discussion meeting, and it didn't produce very much that I remember. And at the close of the meeting, I got up and moved to the door to go out on the street and go home, thoroughly disillusioned with the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous on the basis of what I knew of it at that time. And when I reached the door, a stranger put his hand on my arm, and he smiled the most beautiful smile I think I've ever seen. And his smile said to me, I know you're hurting, buddy. Would you like to just sit down for a couple of minutes? And I thought to myself, well, he's going to ask me all these questions and stuff, but I'll do the best I can. And we sat down together, and he didn't ask me any questions. He told me how it was with him. He told me how it was with his family, what he had done to them as a result of his illness of alcoholism, and how they'd been affected by it, and how in the midst of all this, he had finally reached Alcoholics Anonymous, and what the result had been for him. The changes that had come about in his life and in the life of his wife and his children. This guy wasn't even a member of a group in Richmond, in my hometown. He was from Cleveland, Ohio, and he just happened to be passing through town. Isn't that marvelous? Just happened to be in town. Twice a year he came by as a drug salesman. This was one of those times. And as that man sat there and told me about the experiences of his own life, I could see forgiveness had reached him. And I could see that he was saying to me, whatever it is that's bugging you, and whatever is eating your insides out, I want you to know I care about you and I forgive you. And somehow or another, this was enough for me to think this forgiveness bit is real. It's real. And on the basis of that, I was able to accept forgiveness from the God of my understanding. I learned from it that you can't give forgiveness to somebody else unless you have experienced forgiveness yourself. And those of us who in our little worlds find difficulty in forgiving our spouse and our children, our employers and our friends, take it to heart. You can't give away what you don't have. If you're finding difficulty in forgiving someone close to you, experience your forgiveness with the God of your understanding. Then you'll have it to give away, but not before. Not before. My alcoholism, I built this prison of forgiveness. Now I'm trying to build a bridge that includes the grace of forgiveness. In my alcoholism, I built a prison of the inability to love. And this, to me, is the most horrible prison of all. The inability to share myself in a meaningful way with another human being. The inability to say even to my wife, who I wish to God were here today. The inability to say even to my wife, honey, I'm worried. Honey, I'm scared. Honey, something is happening that I don't understand and it's bothering me. The inability on my part to just open up to her enough to let her be a part of my life. If I couldn't open up to her, I certainly couldn't open up to anybody else either. The inability to love means for me the inability to open myself up to another human being. That was the greatest prison I've ever had. That is still the prison that bugs me most. That is the one I have the most trouble with today. During the weekend, somebody said something to me about the fact that he felt like sometimes he was a phony. Then he went on to imply, but you know, you're not. I said, oh, my friend, there are those days and those hours when the phoniness that I know just drives me up the wall. And any time you get a speaker before you who implies otherwise, you just remember he'll lie about something else, too. We're all phony. The big thing is we learn to be a little less phony as time goes by. The program teaches us that we don't have to be phony, that we can learn to live as real people, at least part of the time, and not as phonies all the time. A prisoner of the inability to share myself with another human being. The last drunk I was on lasted for 3 weeks. And there'd been many, many of them because I started drinking at the age of 9 and had my last drink 25 years later. And the whole thing got progressively worse, as you know. But the last one was 3 weeks. And I came home at the end of my 3 weeks drunk. And I'd always lost my key. It just happened to me automatically. This meant, you know, having to knock on the door and hoping to God that the wife would let me in. And she let me in. And in a few minutes after I got inside that house, I wanted nothing more than to put my arms around her and to say, I love you and I'm sorry. But I couldn't do it. I couldn't open myself up enough to do that. And that night, I wanted to just hold her and to somehow communicate to her without saying anything, you know, that I didn't want it to be this way. But I couldn't bring myself to put my arm around her. I couldn't open myself up that much. A prisoner of the inability to love. After I came to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, I learned a little something about love, too. I learned it for me, the reason why it's so difficult to love is because I don't want to be hurt. Because any time you choose to love, you also choose to lay your neck on the chopping block. You always choose to exercise the possibility that somebody's going to cut it off. And we don't want to do that. I don't. But I've also learned that unless I'm willing to take the chance on love, I will always be a lonely guy. Because the only way you get out of the prison of loneliness is to stick your neck out and take a chance on loving somebody and letting them love you. If you can't take that chance, then you're going to always be lonesome. And if you can take the chance, there may come times when somebody does chop the neck too. But by God's grace, you get it back together again, and you try it again. One final prison I'll mention. There were many others. I'll mention just one more. I wore many masks. I had mental pictures that I wanted you to have of me. I wanted people to recognize me for certain things. Maybe I can illustrate it best this way. I recall one night I'd come home and I was lying on the couch and I'd been drunk for several days and I still had on the same old clothes I started out with, you know, and I hadn't bathed and I hadn't shaved and so on. And I stretched out on the couch with my old dirty feet and my shoes still on. And the wife came through and she said something to me, probably a gentle request to move your feet off the couch. I don't even remember. But I remember very much giving her a snappy answer. And I know that she got a picture of me, a picture of a guy who was trying to say, I'm boss in my own house. I want you to know that, baby. But who was coming through like a real crud. But she got a picture of me. And while I lay on the couch, There was a knock on the door, and some friends from up the street had just dropped by. When the door knock came, you should have seen old Art coming off that couch, trying to get his clothes together, those dirty, tattered clothes that I had on, trying to pull them together so I thought they would look nice, trying to smooth back my hair so that when I opened the door, they would be looking at someone that they could appreciate. And I opened the door. Hello, John. Hi, Sue. Come on in. Gee, it's good to see you. I'm glad you came by the house. And I ushered him into the house and I said, have a seat. Would you like a drink? You want to watch television? Cup of coffee? Trying to be the perfect host because I wanted a picture to be built in their minds of me. And 45 minutes or an hour later when they left, probably because the smell was pretty strong, they went out the street, out the door and up the street. I could hear in my mind Sue saying to John, I wish you were like him. And with that self-satisfied smirk on my face, I went back to the couch to lie down to recreate for my wife that same cruddy picture she'd had a few minutes ago. And there was another picture, too, the one that I saw inside, that frightened the little guy that wanted out so badly. Would the real Art Graham please stand up? I wanted him to come out of there so bad, and I didn't know how to get him out. I didn't know how to get him alive. And I never found out how to get him alive until I came to this program, where people met me with love and with understanding and allowed him to come out. Up till then, people had been telling me to get him out. It's a lot different, you know, for somebody to tell you to get him out, to be the real you. It's a lot different to have somebody tell you to be who you are than it is to have someone love you enough to allow you to be who you are. And that's what you did for me. You allowed me to just be me. Some of us were talking at the table again the other night, and we came to the conclusion that pastors need pastors, you know. And this has always been something you read about in all these theological journals, the preachers read about it anyway, that preachers don't have any pastors. And this is tragically true too often. I got more pastors than any preacher I know, I'll tell you that. And one of the real joys I have is going to AA meetings, you know. Most meetings, most groups, if a preacher walks in, well, you can almost hear things being changed when the preacher comes in. Somebody, the dirty joke hangs in midair, you know, and everybody sort of hates your guts because they didn't get to hear the punchline. And they go. But when I walk into an AA meeting, an AA group, you know, it's Art. They don't give a flap whether it's Reverend Art or not. It's just Art. And the joke or whatever is being said goes on and be said. And I get called some SOBs and other fancy names, you know. And it's marvelous. It's wonderful. I've got it. I really have got it head and shoulders above any other minister who is not an alcoholic and a member of AA. Because I've got pastors that I never dreamed. And they're good pastors because they're you. And you know what's real and what ain't. You can be my pastor. And you are. Anytime. Our purpose also says there are no dues or fees for membership. But all of us in this room know how high is the price that you have to pay in order to qualify for membership. Let us just remember that the price for continued sobriety is also very dear. At the very least, to me, it must include these. The price for continued sobriety must include, for me, a willingness to give God his share of the credit as the architect who draws up the plans for all of life, including mine. A willingness to give God his share of the credit as the master architect. It also means the need that I have continually to do battle with my old enemy, my pride. That joker is there all the time. And if I just let up my guard for one split second, he just moves in and takes over again. The continual struggle with pride for me. Continued sobriety also means for me the ongoing acceptance of the fact that ultimately you and I are responsible for us. You and I are responsible for us. We use a phrase in AA that scares me sometimes. It doesn't scare me when I know what the person is thinking when he uses it. Let go and let God. If I have the feeling that somehow or another when the person is using it, he's just saying to himself and to all who will listen, I'm putting it all on God. I'm going to let him handle the whole thing. I ain't going to have another thing to do with it. Then I tremble in my boots. But if what I'm hearing him say is, I'm recognizing the fact that I can't control my life very well, and I'm asking God to come in and take over the leadership, I'm letting go of control. I'm going to still do the legwork, but I'm letting go of control. If I can do that, then sobriety will continue to be an ongoing thing for me. Continued sobriety means also that every hour, the final decision of whether or not to take the first drink has to be made within the loneliness of my own soul. I can call anybody I want to in AA, I can go to as many meetings as I want to go to, day and night, but the ultimate decision to take the first drink has to be made inside me. All the support that you can give me will not alter that fact. But finally, I am responsible for the first drink, and nobody else. If I'm going to have continued sobriety, it means that we've got to preserve and build this fellowship, this unique fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. When anyone, anywhere, reaches out for help, I want the hand of AA always to be there. And for that, I'm responsible, and you are responsible. In this particular point in time, we need more than ever before to preserve and build the fellowship, because with every passing day, there are more of us hurting out there. And we're the best possible chance they've got. And anything that undermines the fellowship, anything that weakens it in any way, hurts the guy or gal who's still suffering and lessens their chance of knowing what recovery might be. Well, the big book says that our stories disclose in a general way what we used to be like and what happened and what we're like now. And without having given you a blow-by-blow drink, account of my drinking, I should say, I hope that you can gather from what I've said that I used to be lost. I did not know who I was, and I did not know where I was going. If I didn't know who I was, I could not possibly know who I wanted to become. I went around in circles because I had no sense of direction so far as living was concerned. I stood often at the brink of despair. And as I tried to lay out for you, I built many prisons. Well, what happened? I found my pig pen. Every alcoholic has his pig pen, regardless of whether it's on Fifth Avenue or on the Bowery. And you know that story as well as I do that's told in the 15th chapter of the Gospel according to St. Luke about the old prodigal boy who left home, and we're all prodigals, of course. He left home and took what his daddy would give him, and he blew it all. And he came to that point in his life where he had to go looking for some way to support himself. And a young Jewish man took a job feeding the pigs. What a blow to his pride. But out there in that pig pen feeding the pigs, the story says to us, and he came to himself. In AA we say, and I hit my bottom. It's the same thing. He came to himself and he said, I'm going to go home. I'm going to admit to Dad, I'm just going to tell him straight out, I blew it all, Dad. And not worthy even to be your son. Just let me come back and be a servant. Well, that's sort of the way it was with me, too. I found my pig pen. And in the middle of the pig pen, I said, I've blown it all. I want to go home. Where's home? Home for me is AA. For you, home is AA. And you remember that proverbial welcome that the prodigal got when he got home. His dad brought out the ring and put it on his finger to signify the fact he's still a member in good standing of the family. And he brought a robe and he put it around and he put a new shoe on his feet and he said to the servants, kill a fatted calf. My son who's lost has come home. We're going to have a party. And I came to AA and almost literally, and sometimes, as you well know, it has been literally, you put a ring on my finger and clothes on my feet. Clothes on my back and shoes on my feet. And you said, welcome home. We're glad to see you. A marvelous, marvelous experience to come home. I found my pig pen and came home. What am I like now? Well, not quite as lost as I was. A little better. I have some sense of direction in my life. I have some sense of purpose in my life now. I have a center to my life to which I am committed, and his name is Jesus Christ. And I didn't used to have any of those things. And I got them through this program. I know a little bit better now who I am than I did when I came into this program. And because I know a little bit better who I am as a person, I have a little bit better insight into who I want to become as a person. And because I have met that one who is full of grace and know him as my own God and Savior, I feel that I can move from where I am to where I want to be through my Samaria, because I won't be walking by myself. I'll have him, and I'll have you, because he lives in you. Therefore, my life will go ahead with more meaning than it ever has before. I'm still going around in circles a little bit. When I was born, I had like everybody, I had an opportunity to make friends, and my circle of acquaintances began to broaden and broaden and broaden. And then booze came into my life, and my circle of acquaintances began to narrow and narrow and narrow, because people didn't want much to do with me. And when the day came that there was nobody in the circle but me, I knew that I had a noose around my neck. Because when there is nobody left in the circle but yourself, that's what it is. A noose around your neck. Well, I'm still going around in a circle, but the circle has started broadening out again. With each passing day, new people, new friends. Since I've been here this weekend, friends that I never knew existed before. But I've met you here, and I'll go away from here a much richer man because of that. The circle is getting broader and broader. It's a good circle to go around in. I think it's the very best. Sometimes I still stand at the brink of despair, but you taught me something about that. You've taught me that when you stand at the brink of despair, you also stand at the edge of faith, and you make a choice of which way you're going to jump. You jump in faith toward the God of your understanding, or you jump in despair into utter destruction for your life. I take your word for it. I jump in faith toward God as I understand him when those moments come, rather than jump into that bottomless pit of despair. As I tried to indicate to you, I'm building bridges instead of prisons. I've come home to AA and to the proverbial welcome that is a part of the return of every prodigal. Our time has slipped away, and I have one final thing I want to say to you. It's a story that I want to tell you. And I want to tell you to you because it means a lot to me. And some of you have heard it, and it means something to you who have heard it. And those of you who haven't, I hope you'll find meaning in it. This story sums up, better than anything I know, how I feel about the God of my understanding and how I feel about you, how I feel about AA. As you well know, during World War II, our bombers destroyed many, many villages and towns in Europe. And according to this story, in one village in Europe, the local cathedral was totally leveled to the ground. And when the war was over, the people of that village gathered together and they said, the thing we want most in our lives now is to have our cathedral rebuilt, because this is the center of our whole life. They had no money, but everything they had of any material value they brought together and pooled into one huge pile of resources. And with this pool of resources, they said, we will hire an architect to draw up the plans for our new cathedral. We will hire a building contractor to begin building on our building. And they did just that. And the building contractor looked around for the different types of employees he would need. And he found he had no trouble in finding stonemasons and brick masons and carpenters and electricians and plumbers. But when it came to stained glass artisans, it was a different story. There weren't very many to be found. And he needed three in order to finish that cathedral on time. And he searched all over Europe for three and could find only two who would meet his qualifications. He didn't even bother to look in the United States because it was felt that there were no stained glass artisans of that quality in this country. He sat in his office wondering how in the world he would be able to complete the cathedral on time with only two stained glass artisans. One day the door opened and a man walked in and he said, I understand you're looking for a stained glass artisan. And the contractor looked at him and noted his appearance, a little unkempt, clothes that were a little tattered and torn, and he gave the general impression of having traveled a lot of miles. And because of that impression, the building contractor looked at him and said, "Yes, I'm looking for a stained glass artisan. Do you know where I can find one?" The man said, "I'm a stained glass artisan." And the contractor looked at him and laughed. "You? You're a stained glass artisan?" The man said, "Yes, I am." The contractor said, "Well, who are you? What's your name?" The man said, "Well, my name doesn't matter, but believe me, I am a stained glass artisan." And he went on trying to explain to the contractor that he was a good one. And the contractor was finding it awfully hard to believe. And finally, the man said to him, "Look, I know you don't really believe it, but tell you what, let me come to work for you as that stained glass artisan whom you need. And you just give me a place to sleep and 3 meals a day. Pay me no wages. When the job is completed, if you like what you see, then pay me the same thing that you've been paying the other two men." And the contractor thought about it for a moment and realized this was the best offer he'd had. And he said, "All right, we'll try it." And as the man walked out the door, he turned back to the contractor and he said, "Just one thing. I don't like people to watch me while I work. Could you arrange to have a curtain drawn over that area of the wall where my window used to be?" And the contractor said, "Well, yeah, yes, sure, we'll do that." So the contractor had the curtain arranged over this gaping hole in the wall where the window would be that this man would build. The next morning, the man appeared for the work the first day. As he came into the building, he walked by the other two stained glass artisans and he stopped to chat with them for a few minutes. And then he disappeared behind the curtain. During the day, they could hear him moving around in there occasionally and a peck, peck every now and then of a hammer. The days passed and each morning this man would come in and stop for a couple of minutes to chat with the other two stained glass artisans. Then he disappeared behind that curtain and they'd hear the continuous pecking away, pecking away. The days and the weeks passed and the months passed and finally the day of completion of the cathedral was at hand. The contractor called the village priest and all the people from the village came up to examine for the first time the new cathedral that had been built to replace the one so dear to them. And as he led them through the building, he noticed that the man was still behind this curtain over here and he wondered, "Will he be through by the time I get around?" And he finally made the swing around the base of the cathedral and came over here to this side of the wall. And as he walked up with the people from the village, the artisan stepped out from behind the curtain and looked at the contractor and he said, "It's finished." The contractor didn't have a chance to preview the work before he showed it to the people. And he was churning up all kinds of acid in his stomach as he thought to himself, what's going to happen if I pull this curtain back and it's a dud? But he had no choice. He pulled the curtain back, and there before their eyes, the most beautiful stained glass window that they could have ever wished for. So beautiful, in fact, that all of them stood in utter awe and silence, unable to speak a word for several seconds. And finally, the contractor found his tongue, and he turned to this man, and he said, "Who are you?" The man said, "I told you in the beginning, my name doesn't matter. Tell me, do you like my work?" The contractor said, "It's magnificent. It's just magnificent. I've never seen anything to compare with this. And if you won't tell me who you are, would you at least tell me where you got the glass for this window? It's so far superior to the glass in the other windows." And the man smiled, and he said, "Yes, I'll tell you where I got the glass. Did you know every morning as I came to work, I stopped to talk with the other two stained glass artisans. And as I stood chatting with them, I reached down into the trash can by their workbench. I picked up the discarded fragments and the broken, shattered pieces that they had thrown away. And I carried those behind the curtain. And the window that you see before you has been built from the pieces that the other artisans threw away. The discarded remnants that nobody wanted." Yeah, it's just a story. But it says, to me, God as I understand him, working through you, picked up the broken, shattered fragments of this life that nobody wanted, and you put it back together in a way far more beautiful than I ever dreamed you could be. For that I thank my God. For myself, I give thanks to you.